Hey, this is Ray Park. I play Snake Eyes from G.I. Joe, Retaliation, and Rise of the Cobra, Toad from X-Men, and the Lord of the Sith, Darth Maul from Star Wars. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. You better believe it.
Welcome, true believers. This is Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Thanks for joining me here in the lair, where comic books come to life, and boy, did they ever this past weekend. I had an amazing time at Connecticut Comic Con, and that's what this episode of Comic Book Central is all about. I'm actually going to break this up into two episodes, because there was so much going on. I'm going to try to give your ears a sampling of what the weekend was like for me at the convention. In this episode, I catch up with comic book artists and writers Neil Adams and Jerry Ordway. I sit down for a chat with William Catt, and I'll go toe-to-toe with the Dark Lord of the Sith, Darth Maul himself, Ray Park. Now, before I get to all that, I want to say a big thanks to Connecticut Comic-Con organizer and my buddy from theindycast.com, Mitch Halleck. I haven't heard the final attendance figures yet for Connecticut Comic Con, but I'm telling you what, Mitch took his show to 3 days this year. There were a ton of fans coming in through the doors, and yet it didn't seem overwhelming. I'm telling you, it was an amazing job by Mitch and all the Comic Con staffers and volunteers. I had a great time this weekend. Went really, really well. Very smooth. I'm sure there were some hitches behind the scene, but Mitch made sure we didn't see any of that. He was running around like crazy. I was a dynamo going through all weekend. That was kind of fun watching him kind of run around too, but it was an amazing event. In fact, here is a bit that Mitch and I recorded when he was able to take a two-minute break. I'm not kidding. He was just running around, taking care of everybody all weekend, keeping the convention going. Here is a little bit of myself with Mitch at Comic-Con. Apologies for some of the audio this week. Depending on when and where we were recording, things would get a bit loud at times. We'd kind of have to yell over some things, so some things maybe got a little overmodulated. So hopefully the audio isn't too much off the mark. But hey, it's raw. It's recorded live. It's on the floor of the convention at Connecticut Comic-Con. It is my adventure at Connecticut Comic-Con.
Superman has landed. Comic Book Central, the remote version of the lair, is here in Bridgeport, Connecticut. We're at Comic-Con. Look who I found.
Hey,
Mitch Halleck, my buddy from the IndyCast. Mitch, how are you doing?
I am tired, exhausted, but extremely excited.
This is amazing. I caught you like 2 minutes. All I get is because I've seen the back of your shirt most of the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Boss man, as you're flying away.
Yep.
So thank you for once again inviting me out here.
Yes, sir.
The panel tomorrow, chat with Cap.
Yep,
we're going to be doing that. Just give us an overall view of what Comic-Con 2014 is like, what fans can expect here.
Well, what they're already expecting and seeing with their own eyes is comic books, toys, actors, other fans, anything they want in those big city cons right here in the little old nutmeg state of Connecticut.
Darth Maul,
I'm looking right at Ray Park.
Jasper Sitwell, he's
looking for his action figure, his little mini-me. He and I went toy hunting last night. It was so weird. I'm like, I'm with Jasper Sitwell, looking to find his action figure. So how weird was that?
Hail Hydra?
Yeah, Hail Hydra.
This is a great
show. He does that all day.
I know. I'm going to let you get going.
I have texts from him saying Hail Hydra.
I'm going to let you get going. I've got a bunch of stuff to do.
Yes,
it's all going to be on Comic Book Central.
Yep.
Thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you.
William Catt. I appreciate it.
Yep.
Looking forward to being back with you on the IndyCast again as well.
Yeah.
And let's look forward to 2015.
Yeah, I already got the dates, August 14th and 16th. Mark your calendar.
That is the marketing genius. That is Mitchell Halleck. Yeah, thanks, Mitch. I'm going to go do some crazy comic book stuff.
See you later, Joe. Thank you.
And Mitch invited me to be a part of a podcasting panel while I was there, and that's where I met Brian Letendre and Mattman Herring from the Secret Identity podcast. Brian moderated. We had a pretty good audience. Some podcasters were there looking for some new ideas or maybe some suggestions on how to improve their podcast. Some folks were thinking about starting a podcast for the very first time. So I'm not sure if Brian and Matt are including the audio of the panel on their podcast, but you definitely want to be checking out their show. Check out their podcast. It's secretidentitypodcast.com, and I hope to be able to work with them again real soon. Now, in addition to meeting up with Mitch, another one of our IndyCast buddies made the cross-country flight from sunny California to join us on the East Coast. After all these years of podcasting with him, I finally got to meet Laird Malamed from the IndieCast. Now, Laird used to work on the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles back in the day. We met, at least we met over Skype, through the IndieCast a few years back. Finally got a chance to meet him face-to-face. It was great to meet Laird. And I'm telling you what, whenever we first met, it was like we knew each other forever. I guess we'd been podcasting and talking so long. But it was really cool. Just got to, you know, just felt like we had a long friendship right off the bat. Got to run around and record a bunch of stuff with Laird for the IndieCast, including our adventure in the Raiders of the Lost Ark Peruvian Temple. You know, that's the one where Indy snags the idol and he has to outrun the boulder at the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark. There were some really talented guys that actually built that set piece, and we all got to don the fedoras and pretend like we were Indiana Jones. Here is a bit of that now. You're going to hear the complete segment over on the IndieCast. Oh, another classic Comic Book Central crossover episode. I love those. Okay, here is myself and Laird at Connecticut Comic Con.
Well, this is Laird from the IndieCast. I'm here with Joe from the IndieCast.
For the first time meeting.
Yes, I mean, here we are.
Yes, it is.
This is awesome.
We're meeting in front of Indiana Jones, which is actually, this seems wildly appropriate.
It does feel very, very appropriate. So we are at Comic-Con with two N's in Connecticut, our own out. Mitch Halleck comic show.
Where's Mitch's MIA? We can't even find him.
Well, he's off ranting somewhere. Right. So this is huge. It's in an arena, and we are here with a recreation of the Peruvian Temple that is led by Jay and his team. So let's get them to introduce themselves. So Jay?
I'm Jay Clinton. Basically, I'm the builder. We got Dave Silva.
Hello. Dave Silva.
We have Andy.
And Andy.
All right. So, okay, so describe what we have here for our listeners. This is all audio, so we're gonna have to paint a picture.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so basically we've got the pedestal. We got the idol on top with the sand. And we got the rear wall and part of the floor around it actually done. It's got the diamonds in it with the mud. Basically, the panels you step on with the darts shoot out. So we don't have the darts in there yet. So there's some legality issues.
This is actually the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark when he's going in. You're in the movie right now. I mean, you're in that scene we love where he's kind of standing there eyeing it up. How much sand does he have to knock out of it? How much, like, all before everything just goes nuts and the boulder starts rolling. They've put you in this scene right here at Comic-Con, which is amazing. And look, this had to be like our first stop here.
Absolutely.
And they have where else would we be?
Fedoras you can wear and you get your photo taken, stuff like that. Jay and crew, so who did what here? So Jay's dressed up completely in a very authentic Indiana Jones costume. Andy's dressed up as Sala.
Yeah.
And they're just in kind of shorts and a hat.
I'm with the bad pot.
He's the guy when Harrison's sitting there at the table after Marion dies and those two guys walk by from the crew, they're like smoking a cigarette. He's that guy. He's bringing those characters to life.
It is to life. Okay, so who did what and how long did it take?
Well, Dave, basically, he's the owner of everything. He funded everything. I did all the building. It took about a year. So it's probably after the last Comic-Con we were at with you guys. So, yeah, we just finished. We're working on the map room as well. So I've kind of been working on both of them, but this one we just finished. Technically, we just finished here. As we put up the last wall, we finished the last of the moss we put up. And also we got the pedestal that it actually lowers. We got an actuator on the inside, so when you switch the idol with the sand, you step on the pedal, and it actually will drop down.
All right.
So what's really great about this is that you are in the scene, and you step in here, and you put the sandbag on there, take the idol off, and that goes down, and the rolling thing, it begins.
It begins.
You're here. We're sitting here watching, so we're kind of geeking out at the same time.
Yeah,
here,
I mean, this thing really lowered. It was, and I could hear the earthquake start.
Yeah,
and,
I'm like dodging, dodging the darts at any moment.
Exactly. So you guys are, so it's a buck to get a photo, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what are the other price options?
Yeah, $3 to wear a fedora and stand behind and do the idol swap, and in $5 you can take a video on your phone. And video, and we'll drop down the sand and the idol and the whole spot.
Best deal in the place. Are we doing this?
Yes.
We doing this thing?
We're going to do this.
What inspired you guys to do that? Because, look, we love Indiana Jones, but it's like we really love Indiana Jones, but I don't think Laird and I have ever built anything like this in our garage and had, like, all the floor thing and the idol. What inspired you to do this and to go that step and to get this crazy detail with it?
Yeah, well, basically, our love for the movies and trying to bring the experience out to everybody, I think, is the biggest thing. Dave and I always go back and forth on ideas, and that's where it really balloons from. Dave will be like, oh, hey, this would be a great idea, and then we'll go back and forth on how it can be done. We just want to create the best experience, just because, you know, like Indiana Jones or anything like that, it's just such a huge part of our lives, and just amazing movies. So we really want to just create the best experience that we could for, you know, people coming up.
You guys are taking man caves to, like, the next level. Yeah, right? Yeah, I mean,
our first venture was the Bat Pod, which is the next booth over.
Which looks great.
Yeah, so that was our first venture. This is our second one, okay. And now we're working on the third one, which is the map room, and then we got some ideas. We're not going to disclose them this time.
Because I'm doing Comic Book Central, the other podcast, so we've got Batman, we've got Indiana Jones. Yeah, Can I just hang out with you guys?
He's got the black eye.
Can you guys just adopt me and just leave me in the corner? I just want to, like, play with you guys.
We'll stay down here. We're going to assume it's Batman.
So how many shows a year do you think you guys will start to hit?
This year, we've got about five scheduled this
year. Okay. That's just a hefty load to move this around and truck it all over the place to set it up.
Right now, it's two vehicles, a truck and trailer, and then we have a box truck.
Got it.
You can reenact Cairo with Andy over here.
Yep, sure. It's our map room. It's our map room costume.
Yeah, nice. So, you're gonna chase us around with baskets over our head. And, can we spear you and stuff?
Actually, I guess you look more.
I'm already overheated just standing here.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Overdressed.
That is our map room.
But you're actually really more indie as in disguise than Sala. Now that I think about it.
Yeah.
Well,
because Indy had more of the thing around him.
He's missing his bag.
Absolutely. He does a little pirouette into the tent. And goes
A shorter, older Indy, but yes, it's same. It's identical.
He's getting to be a shorter, older Indy. This is true.
Another
5 years, I'll be standing where Jay's standing, getting the attention.
There we go.
All right, cool.
Oh, man, this is amazing. You guys have to come out and see this. I don't think Laird and I are going to leave the rest of the day. You guys may have just have officially adopted us.
Oh, wait, we have customers coming up.
The customers are coming in.
Let's sign off. This is Laird and...
And Joe. All the folks there at the convention were having a lot of fun at this setup. Young and old were getting a kick out of being Indiana Jones. And next year at Comic-Con, the map room where Indy discovers the location of the Ark of the Covenant. Those guys are going to build that. It's going to be there. I can't wait to see that. As I said, check out the latest IndieCast posting. It's going to be August 25th for more of the adventures of Joe, Laird, and Mitch at Comic-Con. And be sure to check out Jason and Dave's sites for more of their great displays. These guys work with several charities as well. They use these sets in raising funds for those charities, so that's pretty cool. Check them out. Davesdisplays.net is the website. And you can like them on Facebook, facebook.com/Dave's Displays. Now, one of the things I love about Connecticut Comic Con is that they don't forget the source material for our passion. And that is comic books. The legends who have written stories for and who have penciled, inked, and colored our favorite characters. Many of them were there over the weekend. I finally got a chance to meet Herb Trimpe. He was the first artist on Wolverine. He had a huge run on The Incredible Hulk. I also got to meet Denny O'Neill. Perfect time to meet up with Denny O'Neill for the 75th anniversary of Batman. And he played a big part in bringing the Dark Knight Detective back to Detective Comics. Now, Batman had sort of been campy leading up to Denny's run that was coming off the Adam West show, so some of the comics reflected that. Now, both of those talents, Denny O'Neill and Herb Trimpe, they worked on one of my favorite books, The Further Adventures of Indiana Jones. Now, you can hear the interviews that Keith Voss and I did with both of them over on theindycast.com. But here on Comic Book Central, I'm going to bring you my conversations with two more heavy hitters in the comic book world. First up, Denny's partner in crime, or crime solving, that is, with Batman, Neil Adams. Artist-writer Neil Adams' early work was featured in the pages of Archie Comics, Warren Publishing's horror magazines, and even the Ben Casey newspaper strip. But once Neil got a crack at some of the top-tier superheroes for DC Comics, the status quo on comic books changed forever. Iconic Superman covers, striking Batman stories, and along with writer Denny O'Neill, they gave us some gripping social commentary with characters such as Green Lantern and Green Arrow. Environmental issues, racism, drug addiction, no topic was off limit, and sales soared. Now, two of the coolest projects on Neil's resume, at least as far as my childhood goes, first, the Treasury-sized team-up of Superman and Muhammad Ali. That's right, Muhammad Ali. and the classic book and record tales from the 70s. Now, creator credits are hard to find on these comic books that were brought to life on our record players, but there's no doubt Neil Adams' name is synonymous with Power Records.
Here we go again, Batman. Things were too quiet for a while. When your hotline rang, I knew it spelled trouble. Well, I think we'll get a little action now.
Right you are, Robin. The Joker has always been a real challenge. We'll get plenty of action if my memory serves me right. He's a very clever arch criminal who must be put away. Like I said, Commissioner, the Joker doesn't waste any time. The Gotham City Museum of Fine Arts? We're on our way.
What's the pitch, Batman?
No time for talking now, Robin. Into the Batmobile. I'll tell you on the way.
All right, well, if you are a fan of Superman, Green Arrow, Batman, the $6 million man, you are more than likely familiar with my next guest. The word legendary gets thrown around an awful lot. I've done that myself, but I think in this case it would be appropriate. He is also a member of the Comic Book Hall of Fame, two of them. In fact, he is artist Neil Adams. Neil, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
It's a pleasure. Am I a member of the
New York? I think there's just so many of them now.
We used to give awards to ourselves when we had the Academy of Comic Book Arts, and I became president of the Academy, and we didn't have an award. We had to figure out what it should look like, and we had lots of failures in the design. So I finally sat down and I designed it, and it's a lightning bolt sticking in a cube. This came out pretty good, and so. We had, we sent out ballots who would win the thing. I won most of them that year. I was like, what the hell is this? This isn't how it's supposed to work. It's not supposed to work this way.
It's very self-serving of you.
I felt like a jackass, you know? Like, first of all, I didn't even want to do these damn thing, the awards. I didn't think it was a good idea. Let fans do it. And so we did. The decision was made, and I never let... As the president, I would never vote on anything unless there was a split, you know, then I would never vote to settle the split. It had to be this overwhelming majority. So they didn't even let me vote on that. So then nobody could design it but me. So then I ended up designing it, and I got this shelf of these stupid awards. It's the dumbest thing in the world. So you can tell that I'm a little, like, jaded on the award thing. You know, yeah.
The thing is, I guess if you've done enough stuff and it gets appreciated by so many people, they're going to throw awards at you.
Yeah,
and even if you have to make them yourself, why not, right?
It's silly. It's silly.
First comic book you ever remember reading?
Reading?
Yep.
Super Snipe. You don't know what Super Snipe is. Super Snipe is a...
I will admit, you got me on that one.
Right,
so.
No, I got everybody on that. Super Snipe was this about this kid. The guy, they have a bell over there. That's all. It's nothing.
That's Muhammad Ali versus Superman. Right. Round one.
So it's a kid who dreams he's a superhero because it's the beginning of the superhero era. And he goes around if something goes wrong, he gets in a disguise, and he puts a pot on his head, and he gets into long johns and puts a mask on and tries to, you know, rescue the girl or, you know, do something brave. Usually he gets knocked unconscious, which is kind of a silly ploy, and then as he's unconscious, he dreams he's this superhero who looks not unlike himself in the long johns, but more of a superhero, a little bit like Captain Marvel.
Okay.
And so he solves the problem, and then when he wakes up, you know, he has to figure out a way to do it. And sure enough, he does, you know. And I always thought, that's a great character.
Like that would appeal to a kid.
I just loved it when I was a kid. So he was my favorite superhero, Super Snipe.
What was it about comic books that got you thinking, I could probably do this for a living, or I'd like to do this for
Absolutely
a living?
Absolutely nothing. No, I was interested in being either an artist or a scientist. I was interested in science very, very heavily. I was interested in art, but I had a natural ability in art. I had a natural ability in science. I mean, it was science was really easy for me, and I loved it. I used to read science lessons like they were comic book stories. You know, you read the experiment, and then you make the experiment, and then you look for the conclusions. And if you turn the page, then you see the conclusion. So you don't turn the page, you try to figure out what the conclusion will be, and then you turn the page and so it blew up. That's cool.
It's problem solving.
It's problem solving. Very, very much. So I like that a lot. I like the and I wasn't necessarily only interested in drawing. I did like drawing, but you know, when you're the school drawer, the school artist, they have you do everything. And when it comes to, you know, drawing Santa Claus on the board or whatever it is, or doing sets for the plays, you become the gopher to do all this artwork. And that was okay, but to be known that way, because, you know, you get a lot of kudos, and everybody thinks you're special, and you can draw a picture of Atomic Mouse or whatever it is. But the idea of actually telling a story and writing a story, to me, was more fun than the drawing. The drawing came sort of naturally. And I discovered that along the way, you had to learn to draw much, much better to be competitive. So then the pendulum would swing the other way. You have to really focus on the drawing. But I never lost the desire to tell a story. Also, my mother was a great storyteller. My mother was a very funny, natural storyteller.
Dinner table conversation, just lighting
up.
She'd
sit there and talk about days on the farm and beating the pig out and going and torturing the stupid pig, and he would get mad at them and try to butt them
It sounds horrific.
No, it was horrible. But that's the thing about
it. But she told it well.
But she told the story well. I mean, a good story takes a certain amount of tragedy. I mean, if you can't... What good is a story that is just a kind of a light, fluffy story?
Yes. And now the Dark Knight has come in, yes.
Yeah.
Something we will be getting to, yes.
So telling a dramatic story in a funny way was very natural to her. And I loved it. I just love that aspect. And I discovered that there are good stories every day. You know, you think that people... I don't understand that people live the lives that they lead and they don't see the story. More often, what happens is they translate the story into gossip. And then they're talking gossip all the time. And that gossip, more often than not, is a great story. They just ruin the story by telling it as if it were gossip.
Now, working with Denny O'Neill, are you guys the Lennon McCartney of comic books? I mean, this is amazing.
I think that's what other people say.
Yeah.
I think that Denny and I are very different from one another, and we are kind of the Lennon and McCartney in that we're both. One of us is an artist. Both of us are storytellers. A lot of people don't know that I wrote most of Dead Man. A lot of people don't know that Denny had to opt out of Superman versus Muhammad Ali, and I wrote it, even though Denny wrote some of it. And it was originally my story. There's very little in the Green Lantern Green Arrow series that I wrote because I was very satisfied with the work that Denny was doing. And I just essentially sat back and did my job and let him do his job. But it's sort of like a movie director. How many movie directors can write and also hire other writers to write scripts for them? As often as not, you'll find the script will come in by somebody else and then the director will take over and rewrite it. I never did that with Denny, but I did create the drug issue first cover. Which essentially...
Landmark issue.
Which, if you looked at the cover, and I did that cover before we did anything on the story, if you look at the cover, you could write the story yourself. It's pretty clear. It was very hard
It was back in the day when comic book covers actually told a story.
Right.
Well, we could do it.
Right.
You didn't have to just have an image.
Same thing with the Green Lantern... Black Green Lantern. Essentially, I told the story to Julie Schwartz, and that got translated into a story by Denny O'Neill.
And we're in the 75th anniversary of Batman now, and so your work with Denny on this was just phenomenal.
And this is not... I don't want to say anything negative about Denny, because Denny did a fantastic job, and I agree with everything that people say, except I want to give some credit to Bob Haney, who did the issues of Brave and Bold that I drew and were the first changes of Batman. I mean, people think that it was Denny and I that changed Batman. It really wasn't. It was Bob Haney and myself that changed Batman. And then after about five issues of Brave and Bold that Bob Haney wrote, Julie Schwartz finally relented and realized that, well, of course, the fans were writing letters to Julie saying that the only Batman at DC Comics is the one in Brave and Bold. And so he kidnapped me from Murray Boltonoff and insisted that I work for him in Detective and Batman, which were on the verge of being canceled. And then he gave me as a writer, asked me if I would work with him, Denny O'Neill. And the reason that I decided, yes, that it would be a good idea was that I was told that by Dick Giordano that Denny had been a reporter. And he worked on the Night Beat, I was told. And I thought, you know, that's going to be some gritty stuff. And probably he would do a good job. So following Bob Haney, who did a fantastic job, and if you look at the reprints, you can read his stuff. You just have to look at the credits. Batman Sergeant Rock, Batman Teen Titans, Batman Aquaman, Batman Flash, all those stories were terrific. Yes, and then we went in and Denny and I did Batman together. So the credit has to be shared between Haney and Denny, I believe. But Denny did add, over and above everything that was being done, over above anything Haney and I had done, a sense of avoiding the clowns and doing the realistic stuff. And that contribution really is kind of missed a little bit by people because we've kind of gone back to the clowns. So when you get too far into the fantasy, I find that it's a little hard to take. And what Denny did was he made it very realistic. On the other hand, even within the realism, the very first story that he did had a touch of fantasy. He had these people living forever, inhaling the smoke from you know, the fumes from flowers, which essentially would be poppies, yeah, which would be a kind of drug addiction. So there was a fantasy and a drug addiction commingling there.
Definitely wasn't kid stuff.
It wasn't definitely not
him growing up stuff.
Right, right.
Well, something that actually is kid stuff that was one of my favorite projects, one of your little more offbeat projects that you had, something I remember growing up, and on Comic Book Central, we're all about bringing comic books to life, book and record sets were one of my favorite things. I have them to this day. I love listening to Power Records. Right. Yes. You did so many of those covers. I'm thinking Superman, Batman.
Not only the covers, but we did
the
so
interior,
many stories.
The interior artwork.
Not just the interior art. We wrote the stories.
So did you actually, because a lot of these things are uncredited on the Power Records.
Those
so did you actually
did.
Write
well,
some of
the
stories?
Up to the point that other people took it over. But I did Star Wars, Star Trek. Stories. I did the Batman stuff.
Like stacked cards or something. I think one was stacked cards for Batman.
Like that. Yeah, that's mine.
You wrote, okay.
Yeah, I did a lot.
See, that's tough because there's no credits on them. That's
but
the crazy
nobody
thing.
Cared. We didn't care. To me, it was a commercial
we
job.
We cared. Kids.
Oh, man, I understand. I get it.
Hunkered around our little photograph records.
I loved it. Conan stories. I did a swamp creature story.
How did those projects come to you?
Huh?
The book and record sets. How did they come to you? How did those projects come to you?
They came to us because they were essentially a commercial job. They were looking for people who could do comic books but who worked on a commercial level and didn't work for DC and Marvel Comics.
There's the man himself as he's walking by.
Sure.
Having a surreal moment as I'm watching Denny O'Neill walk by Neil Adams as I'm sitting amongst all their art and work. It's amazing. That was a surreal geek moment. Sorry, I just had to have that.
No, it's all right.
But the Power Record sets were fantastic. What do you think of them when you look at some of those covers and things?
I think they were very... First of all, I'm a big fan of radio shows. And those things were a little more than radio shows that were of popular characters. And you could run a station on playing those Power Record stories as radio shows, and you would get quite a few listeners on the internet, of course, but essentially they were terrific. And I also one of the things about my writing style, some of the stylistic things that I do with Batman Odyssey, is you get to hear them. with the Power Records, and you hear them spoken the way you'd hear movie dialogue, and it's different, a little bit different. There's stuff that if you write it that way, it doesn't sound good when people say it.
Yeah.
And you get a sense of naturalness if you write that stuff, and then you cringe when it doesn't come out right, and then you learn to write it slightly differently.
Do you think they did an okay job with them?
Oh, they did a great job. Yeah. They hired professional actors and did a fantastic job.
Yeah.
And I get people coming to me all the time saying, I still have that, I still listen to it.
Yep.
It's just... No, it's.
I get them on my iPod.
No, it is endless. The digital versions. These stories are great, and they're like the television shows, essentially like the comics brought into like they were television shows, but you can't see the pictures.
Yeah.
You know, we did the Star Trek ones. I had the greatest time because it was like radio shows. You could use your imagination. So if a star was alive and had a voice and could speak, you can't, it's very hard to do that in a television show. It's you can do it in a movie because you got $200 million to spend, but otherwise you can't. But to do it in effect a radio show, a lot easier because you just hear the voice talking and put some effects on it and stuff. So we got to do a lot of great stories, and most of the ones that were uncredited were mine.
Well,
I just sat there and just cranked stuff out.
I can appreciate them on a whole new level now, because now that I know you wrote part of these things, and so now I could listen to them. Oh, that's amazing. So now, and I've got the digital versions. There's a website that put all digital versions out, so I listen to them on my iPod all the time.
Is there really?
There's a whole website that took all of them and recorded them and put MP3s out, and so you download them, and I listen to them, and some have the PDFs of the art.
I gotta go get them.
It's pretty cool stuff. So, hey, talking about, what are you doing up? What are you doing now, and how can fans find out more about you? Website? Facebook?
Well, it's very hard to find my website. It's neiladams.com.
I think we'll try to figure out how to remember that.
I don't know how you find that, but try Neil Adams and then dot and then com.
And we'll take you there. And you can see all the latest and greatest about in the world.
Yeah, you can see the stuff. I'm still doing science stuff, so you could go to YouTube and see my science videos. And if you want to argue with me, and if you want to argue with me, be prepared to have your body flayed of flesh, because I'm not a good person to argue with. Yes, we try to have constant updates on the internet, and my daughter writes a ton of stuff on Facebook, so because she gets the questions. What is your father doing? Oh, okay. And so she writes things on Facebook that tell people where I'm at and what I'm working on and stuff. And she'll post things.
Excellent.
So that you can see drawings as things are going along. And I'm doing a Superman New Gods, Jack Kirby's New Gods. And I'm trying not to screw up New Gods the way everybody else seems to have screwed up New Gods. And try to reintroduce them into the DC Universe, because I think DC Universe ought to represent them and ought to have them available. I mean, certainly the Smallville TV show was beginning to bring New Gods into the TV show before they decided to go ahead and cancel it. And so there are people who are quietly out there know that the New Gods are out there, you know. Granny Goodness showed up for a little bit, and we want to see that kind of
stuff.
There's
some animated stuff, too. Yeah. They did some animated stuff for the characters, so it's out there.
So I'm doing a six-issue miniseries.
When can we look forward to that?
Well, as soon as I get enough books into them to make them happy, and I just finished my first one. So it's going to be pretty soon.
And it'll be updated on the website, and we'll look for that.
Oh, yes.
Sounds good. Well, Neil, thank you so much for joining me today, and thank you for a huge part of my childhood. Those book and record sets, I love them. I still have them to this day, so it's very cool to be able to meet
them. You've got to promise to read Batman Odyssey now.
I will do. Neil, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. I appreciate it, and have a great rest of the convention.
I have to admit, I knew Neil Adams was the artist on a lot of those book and record sets, but I was not aware he was the writer on many of them. See, even I'm learning things on Comic Book Central. And you can learn a lot more about Neil himself. Check out his website, neiladams.com. Now, in addition to Neil Adams, I had the privilege of meeting up with another brilliantly gifted artist, Jerry Ordway. Now, Jerry is a huge Captain Marvel fan, and one of the greatest works of his is the graphic novel, The Power of Shazam. He was the writer, penciler, inker. He did just about everything on the book. And 25 years ago, Jerry produced some incredible art for the DC Comics adaptation of Tim Burton's Batman film. I had a chance to sit down with Jerry and talk about Batman for the 25th anniversary of the movie and the adaptation he produced along with writer Denny O'Neill.
Continuing our interviews here at Connecticut Comic Con, Comic Book Central, always about bringing comic books to life. It's the 75th anniversary of Batman, 25th anniversary of Batman the movie. Tim Burton, Michael Uslan, they brought the comic book to the screen. The man I'm sitting with right now, he took it back to the comic book farm. It is Jerry Ordway. Jerry, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, thank you.
How are the lines were huge today. I mean, you've been like one of the busiest.
It's gratifying.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've done so many comics that there's so much stuff for me to sign. I mean, I've worked in comics since 1980, so.
Like every character. Like
I've
almost
really
every character.
Touched a lot of different characters. I mean, probably pretty much everybody.
Regardless of what character you're a fan of, Jerry Ordway has probably had a hand in bringing some of that.
I also worked on a lot of crossovers. So, I mean, just even if I just did Crisis or worked on Crisis, it would be almost like enough because Crisis involved every character in the DCU.
Well, I'm catching you mid-sketch here. What are we looking at as you're drawing? Describe to our listeners.
I'm drawing a Liberty Bell from the All-Star Squadron, which was a book I did in 1981 to 1983, 84.
Your favorite character to sketch at a convention?
I always like drawing Captain Marvel and Superman. Those are my two go-tos.
I had a sneaking suspicion it was going to be Captain Marvel, so that's it. Before we get into Batman, thoughts on Captain Marvel, Shazam, the movie possibly coming out. We have no idea what's going on with that, but what do you think? You think it's going to translate to the big screen?
I think it actually fits better nowadays. The sensibility would be better in a movie or TV. I mean, I was always surprised Warner didn't do a cartoon series because he's got like the most colorful rogues gallery of villains. Weird. Just almost a
Mr. Mind.
Right, almost surreal.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, I mean, the character itself is, reinvented every couple of years. But to me, if you do it, it's one of the few characters left that has a really, it's got a lighthearted feel to it no matter what you do because he's a kid at heart.
Right.
So my feeling was always that Captain Marvel was this kid and he becomes a superhero and I mean, you just don't worry. You never think you're going to lose because you're the world's mightiest mortal.
Right.
So you're smiling. You're happy. You're punching guys. You're smiling. To me, that's still the essence of his character.
Well, we talked to Jackson Bostwick, and he had mentioned that was his take on it, that it was a young boy as a superhero, and that's why he was always shy around girls and holy moly and all that stuff.
And I was surprised. I was drawn and writing. Started out writing the Shazam comic in 95. And I had people asking me about, well, is Billy Batson Captain Marvel? Or is Captain Marvel a different person? And I was like, wow, I never even ever entertained the thought that he wasn't Billy Batson.
But that was a thing, yeah.
Right. It's like, no, he's transformed into Billy. He's transformed from a kid, but he's still Billy.
Right, mentally.
He just has the wisdom of all these characters.
Yeah.
So that was, I mean, it never seemed like anything for people to argue over.
Right. And now it's a thing, so now you're pulled into these discussions. What's your perception? Is that it's him as a kid, right?
Oh, it's definitely him. Yeah. I mean, I had this discussion with, there's certain guys, like when I was working on Superman, when I was writing and drawing, Clark Kent was the real guy. And other comic creators, especially Mark Waid, always felt like, oh no, Clark Kent is a pretense.
The costume, the guys.
It's like, it never made sense to me because he was raised on Earth. So I always equated it with being adopted. You know, you're adopted by a family, that becomes your family, and that becomes your pattern.
And that's who you are.
And that's how we always approach that book, is that if someone else had adopted him, he would have changed, he would have been different. But it's still Clark Kent. So even though he's an alien, he grew up thinking he was a human, and he grew up with that sense of morality that the Kents gave him.
Well, that was the take on Red Sun when he was in Russia.
Right,
he was so he became the other.
Right, there was never an idea that this guy was, going to be a threat to anybody because he was raised right. You know, it was the nature versus
the moral center. Yeah.
Right. The he's an alien. Okay, well, that's why Superman was the pretense for us, because he became Superman to protect his private life. He needed a separation. It wasn't that he became Clark Kent and put glasses on to become someone. You know what I mean? That's always been this weird argument, but to me it made more sense that he was genuinely Clark Kent. He was raised as...
The psychology of comics. It's deep stuff. It's not just for kids. we mentioned the 25th anniversary of Batman the movie. How did the comic book adaptation come to you, and how in the world did you get all these amazing likenesses? Because everything is dead on in the book, and it's tough to get Michael Keaton back.
My buddy, Jonathan Peterson, was the editor of the project. He had edited Superman Quest for Peace as a comic adaptation. He's a huge movie buff. He and I would see movies together. He was really my good buddy. Well, he had said, we had talked about this many times, DC had started doing movie adaptations, and most of them were just never given, like, the top tier of talent. It was no offense, but it was like the project nobody wanted to do, really.
So they always wanted that. It's not an original.
Right, and we kept saying, look, there's huge potential in bringing people into comics. If this movie is good or bad, the movie's reaching millions of people worldwide that the comics were not. And we thought if we gave them a really good representation, that it would be, yeah, a lot of work. But I wouldn't have done it without having likeness approval. So in other words, to me it was a deal breaker. It had to look like the movie. I didn't want to do a generic thing. And so we talked about it. That came about, like, okay, we'll try it that way. And we'll see if we can get approvals and see what we can. And he was really the advocate for that. I mean, once we discussed it, he went to bat and contacted the Warner Publicity Department and tried to make sure that there was at least an open dialogue, so that if in a movie they always change stuff. That original screenplay for the movie was very different from what the movie was.
Was there a scene where Batman's on a horse?
It was a whole different... I mean, they came up with stuff as the movie was being filmed. And usually that usually never works out well. But, like the whole Jack Napier as the creator of Batman by killing his parents, that was not part of it. That was kind of like... All that stuff was kind of like, hey, what if we did this? So the irony really to me is always that Sean Young was supposed to play Vicki Vale. She got injured. She
broke
her arm.
I think it was on that horse scene. I think they were shooting the horse scene.
Well, she was training for the horse scene.
Right.
So she lost that part. She broke her arm, and then that scene never was even in part of the movie.
That's the most amazing part, yeah.
How sad, you know, because that took her from A-list to B-list.
Right.
You know?
And there's that whole Frank Miller aspect, too, of The Dark Knight with him on the horse. And it would have been cool to see that on the big screen. But,
right, absolutely.
So you had... What reference did you have when you were putting the comic book together? Did you have, like, publicity shots? Were they sending you stuff? Did you get to screen the film ahead of time?
No. We had contact sheets. We had some stills, but we didn't have many stills with the actors. We had shots... Like, every movie production has a set photographer, and they basically take millions of pictures, and it's all the shots of here's whatever location it was, interiors, exteriors. In this case, it was a set by Pinewood Studios, so there wasn't a lot of, the exteriors only wrapped one floor, and then the rest of it was matted in. I went to a convention in the UK, in London, in 1988 in October, previous to this, and part of that, I was lucky enough to get to go see the movie set, because it was DC, GenetCon.
You get to go on the set.
Yeah, a lot of the guys, people who showed up for this show, they GenetCon had gotten people a little tour. My wife worked at DC in the publicity department, so she was able to pull strings because we couldn't fit into that tour, so we got a separate one on our own, and I got to see the costume. Awesome looking up close. We got to see the car up close. You know, as I get to see the walk through the set.
And just for listeners, nothing had been done like this up at that point. It was just the Adam West Batman, which for point of reference. So this is huge.
Well, it was a big budget movie, and at Pinewood Studios, which is kind of funny because Pinewood is now back in the swing of hosting big movies. At that time, all they did was James Bond, and a lot of the big movie productions. You know, especially the European ones, or that were worldwide, really was only James Bond, and the publicist there had bemoaned the fact that they were worried that Heim was going to have to sell off the land for development because all they had was James Bond. You know, so they're tied. The tide's turned. They're filming all kinds of stuff there now, which is kind of neat because it's isolated, far from London, big space. There's just no big spaces like that anymore. So anyway, seeing the set, that kind of triggered some of this stuff. And then, seeing how awesome the costuming, it was a lot of beautiful work, a lot of really talented people working on it. So that kind of at least ignited it. And anybody who was a comic fan at the time was like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is going to, Jack Nicholson's going to be the Joker. It's like, wow, that's the dream, the dream guy for the Joker. And I was a big Michael Keaton fan. I was never one of the naysayers. So everybody I knew within the DC Comics community, we're all happy. We had heard Jeanette Kahn had confided to us a couple of years earlier that Tim Burton was the guy they were grooming to do Batman. This is when Pee-wee's Big Adventure, before it had come out. And so they had him in mind for that before Beetlejuice or whatever. So it was really exciting, It was like, wow, this is going to be a thing. So I was obviously interested even before the fact.
Now, when you were on the set, did you get to meet the actors?
No, nobody was filming at that point.
Okay, so just an empty set.
Yeah.
But it gave you enough ideas that you could go back to the drawing table and go, okay, now I know where I'm going with this.
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't let us take any pictures.
Right.
But you said
there were others that were taking pictures and sending them to you.
Right, they had their set photographer. It was very inspiring to see all the work and all the... Anton Furst did this awesome set design. And even seeing stuff under construction was really just... It was mind-blowing. I'd never really been on a movie set or any of that before, so it was doubly exciting. But anyways, Jonathan and I were, like, hyped for this thing. We said, wow, this would be great. And once I agreed to do it, it was like Denny O'Neill was going to write the adaptation, and Denny wrote the screenplay. We had like a firm timetable. It was very tight because you had to have it done. There was no way to see the movie before, so we had to do a lot of guessing, educated guesses. But we were getting contact sheets, so as the movie changed, so that we weren't stuck with the script as Denny wrote it. Jonathan went to Denny and said, will you change the script to accommodate? And Denny said, if you want to do it, have fun. He was like, basically, he's doing other stuff.
Yeah.
So Jonathan and I basically got to rewrite whatever was changed and try to adapt to the...
Okay.
We see contact sheets, and it's like, wait, that's not in the script. Wait, there's this sequence of Bruce Wayne and Vicki Vale's, where he encounters the Joker.
Yeah.
A lot of that stuff wasn't in the script. So we had to figure out where it would organically fit. So it was a lot of detective work, and one of the biggest challenges was, again, I was writing it, I was penciling and inking it, and the deadline for finishing it was the end of April. Now, the movie was
opening in June. We got a movie coming out, it's marketing, we got to get this stuff out there.
Right, and we had gotten a special deal. The DC was very excited. The guy who was a circulation director at DC had worked a deal to where this one, they would get it sold in the movie theaters. Which was amazing. It was like opening up almost 1,000 new venues, plus its point of purchase.
For people that want to see more Batman, they're already in a Batman frame of mind.
See the movie, you can get the comic book.
Of course.
Well, so all these things were like really exciting because really, my thing was always to get more people to read DC Comics. I was like, once I committed to DC, DC was my family. We went out of our way to try to work deals and all that. So it was very exciting. But up until the time we saw the movie, we didn't really know how much we got right. It was really like a mystery because we never saw the final sequence. That a lot of it was model work, the bell tower. Some of the things that they cut at the last minute. It was little stuff.
Yeah.
It was pretty awesome.
What did you think when you saw the movie and comparing it to your book?
It was like, we both high-fived each other. At the end of the movie, it was like, we got it.
Yeah.
We got like 98% of it. And it was really...
I'd give you 100.
No, but I mean, as far as being even close to the structure, we missed a few little scenes.
It's amazing.
We were happy to be, successful. And it looked like the movie, all that stuff. And again, there were a lot of things that happened with it that were very specific to our experience. Jonathan and I had talked about the schedule and the fact that the deadline was tight. The possibility arose that we could get them to sign off on likenesses based on sample drawings rather than have to submit finished work to each of the actors' representatives when it was really needing to go
save yourself some time. Yeah.
So we got approvals up front. They basically signed off, yeah, we trust this guy to do. And Keaton signed off. Kim Basinger signed off, by the way. Nicholson rejected it the first batch, and I went back into the second batch. He just didn't think I captured him. But I also, at the time when I was doing these, I didn't have reference. I was using whatever sneak shots were listed in Time Magazine.
Yeah.
They had a shot of the Joker. And I had to draw a couple of representational angles that we just didn't have. So I was making it up based on whatever movie clipping pictures I could get of Nicholson. And I had some... It was still a fair process. So they signed off on it, so we didn't have to submit anything after that point. You know, the book, as we finished pages, they could go to the colorist, and it was really like a smooth process in a harrowing situation. It wouldn't have been, I mean, it really would have been hard to do without having some kind of a rubber stamp on that approval.
Well, it's an amazing job, and just even looking at that last page, if you get the Batman comic book adaptation, just the last page of this, that shot of Michael Keaton, that's a poster. That could be a movie poster right there.
The interesting thing about that, and the story behind that, is that was drawn out of sequence because DC, publicity-wise, had arranged with New York Daily News, which had a huge Sunday circulation, to use that drawing as the cover for the Daily News magazine when they had a Sunday magazine, like the Times has their Sunday magazine. So that was why we drew that ahead of... We probably drew that in... I mean, again, I'm thinking we did it well before the end of the book, out of sequence, so that it would be available. Because they had a lead time for the magazine. And again, it makes no sense that they had that much lead time, but I think the magazine came out the week before the movie, as an advance. But for whatever reasons, it was just like, okay, we can get one page done. And other stuff we were still waiting on for reference, the hope that we could get maybe a reference for that bell tower sequence and just specific stuff, like what are the guys, the Joker's goons attacking Batman, how's that sequence look? It was definitely a lot of guesswork, educated guesswork. But the funny thing to me, one of the interesting... When they came close to the movie being released, word came down. Everybody looks at this movie now and it's like, oh, of course it would be a great hit. And quite honestly, Warner Brothers was, to excuse the expression, they were crapping in their pants up until the first gross came in. Because they can go either way. And that was a competitive summer. You had a James Bond movie, you had an Indiana Jones movie, you had a Star Trek movie. You had it was one of the first that was top-loaded with genre pictures. So they were worried, and they decided we don't want the comic in the movie theaters in the first week. So we were all really deflated and sad because that was when the movie made $50 million. That would have been the biggest audience for it. But they decreed they didn't want to see it. It's just always funny. You don't know what the actual decision making is, but somebody at Warner was afraid that DC Comics, who created or, you know, developed and published that character, was somehow going to embarrass the movie by having a comic book. Like, oh, so we got the
it book. Is a comic book. You know. It's like, well, why are
they were selling come? Like a big budget movie. Okay. So we wound up having to wait till the second week. It still sold a lot of copies in the theater venue. So that was good. And we still did, you know, DC had an ad in there for, you know, finding comic stores, and it was an outreach for us, and very successful. Plus, the book, by nature of being a movie and a successful movie, the Batman book, we got reprint editions in many territories that never sold Batman comics. There's a Saudi. This is amazing for that time. Japanese language version. Japan never. They would create their own Batman. They wouldn't reprint American comics. they reprinted that. Saudi, in Arabic, Batman. Arabic was huge because they weren't reprinting comics in those territories either. So I think we gained. I always felt like that was the best kind of outreach, was to put positive stuff out there. You know what I mean? Like, how do you win over people? Well, you win over by, look, we've got McDonald's or we've got Sears or whatever it was in the 70s and 80s, and, you know, that's better than invading a country, you know? Not only political,
but in 1989, you couldn't even go anywhere without seeing the bat symbol.
Right,
it was it.
It became such a huge thing.
Yeah.
The other funny thing, I guess, like, anecdote out of this whole thing is that DC and Jonathan and actually our situation having the, like, a pre-approval for our likenesses, DC and the toy companies, everybody was caught off guard. So ultimately DC, and we were the only ones who had any kind of Batman movie art likeness approval. That's the only sign-offs that were ever given. So they took the art from the comic and they paid me an extra fee, which was very generous of them, and they created a style guide of the comic art because the actors didn't want, I don't think anybody wanted themselves in costume and photograph form on T-shirts and things like that. So this was kind of like a way to bridge that and still have it be comics. So they created a very successful style guide, which even was used for Batman Begins, or Batman Returns, whichever was the second movie.
Batman Returns.
Yeah. And even though I wasn't involved with the comic on that one, that style guide was still sold because we were the only ones who had that sign-off from Keaton and, you know, Nicholson. It was amazing. It was really, like, very fortuitous for DC because licensing was within in-house. And having the actors say they don't want pictures of themselves in costume as part of licensing, put it all in DC, so DC was able to generate that profit. Even though they all got a cut of it, nobody's reputation suffered. You know, like Nicholson, those guys were, I think, more worried about being on a soda bottle. Or on, you know what
well,
I mean?
Well, yeah, I think like, with his $50 million, he was okay with
didn't
it.
Want to, they didn't want to somehow cheapen the movie in that sense of being, hey kids, I'm Batman, drink milk, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, they do it now you see it everywhere.
Right, but at that time,
no, a whole different ballgame.
They were, yeah, and it was an artistic decision on their part because they gave up probably tons of endorsement money they could have gotten, but it kept the movie, and it kept the advertising.
Well, it's a stunning adaptation. It's one of my favorite. It may be the best adaptation that I've seen. How can fans find out more about what you're doing now? Website, Facebook, where?
I'm on Twitter. I don't know how Twitter works exactly.
I don't. It's Twitter, like the balloon at the end of Wizard of Oz. I can't come back. I don't know how it works.
On Twitter, I'm Jerry Roadway. I think it's like capital J, capital O. And,
I'll find it. We'll put the link up on
right,
the show notes.
On
yeah.
Facebook, I have a fan page. It's daordster, daordster. And it's a public fan page. So people can post art on there, stuff of mine, or they can post comments and things. It's nice.
And find out your latest and greatest.
Right. I always post art, you know, like drawing tutorials, you know, drawing a cover from sketch to finish, and just for fun. So
sounds great. We'll check
those
that. Out. Jerry Ordway, thank you so much for
thank
your
you.
Years of incredible characters, and thank you for this amazing adaptation.
Oh, thank you. It was very gratifying, very tiring, but ultimately very gratifying.
And happy 25th anniversary
thank
of Batman
you.
The movie.
Thank you very much.
Remember, you can follow Jerry on Twitter at Jerry Ordway, and be sure to give him a like on Facebook. Now, switching gears from artists and writers to actors. While I was at Connecticut Comic Con, I had the honor of moderating a Q&A session with my guest from episode 31 of Comic Book Central, William Catt, from the hit ABC TV series The Greatest American Hero. What made this day extra special was the fact that right before our session, the band High Adventure, led by Glenn Nelson, was performing a set of TV theme songs, and they played us on with a theme from The Greatest American Hero. Believe it or not, and I almost didn't believe it. Oh, what a moment. So I want to thank Glenn and High Adventure for that amazing moment. I have to admit, standing next to William Catt while he watched them perform the theme song, that was pretty cool. That was really, really cool. William even photobombed somebody that was recording it on their phone. That was an exceptionally funny moment. I'm sure a memorable video for them as well. Okay, here it is, part of my chat with William Catt.
And without further ado, I'm going to introduce your panel host, Mr. Joe Stuber from Comic Book Central, great podcast, the IndieCast. He'll be talking to Mr. William Catt, the greatest American hero right now. So let's give it up for Mr. Joe Stuber and Mr. William Catt.
Thank you, Mitch. Mitch Halleck, this is day three of Comic-Con. How's everybody doing?
Day three. Good thing it was on day four. He was not able to speak.
All right. Well, welcome, everybody, to the chat with William Catt.
Right on.
We've got some horror fans in the audience as well. Yes, we do. So we got Carrie and House.
Yeah.
We can talk about. We'll get to these things. Also, Rob Star Stage on Broadway. Pippin.
Oh, yeah.
New revival coming up.
A couple things in New York.
Yeah, and we might get to Greatest American Hero, too. I think we might have a few fans of that television show as well.
Good.
But we'll take a Q&A in a little bit. So think about your questions ahead of time. Think about a backup question in case somebody steals your first question. But my first question is, what really sparked your interest in acting in the first place? I know your family is...
Well, my mom and my dad are both actors, probably pretty well known to most people now. My dad, Bill Williams, was a star of a lot of cowboy westerns at RKO in Columbia in the 50s, 40s and 50s, and most famously known for Kit Carson. And he did Date with Angels with Betty White, who's... having a great second half of her life right now, but she did a series with my dad called Date with the Angels. And then he did episodic work and stuff as he got older, and he kind of migrated into, became a developer and went into real estate and whatnot as he got older. My mom, though, is famous for her, she was an actress in the 40s and 50s and 60s and even in the 70s and 80s as well. She was most famous for Della Street in the Perry Mason series that ran from mid-50s to early 60s, and then again from 85
to 30 TV movies.
And they did 10 years again from 1985 to 1995.
Wow. And you got a chance to work with her on a few occasions, not only on those TV movies, right, but also on The Greatest American Hero.
Right.
What was it like working with Mom? What did Mom teach
you?
Well,
you know, my mom and I have always had a great relationship, so it's fun. And it's kind of neat to be peers and you know, on an even playing field where we're just professional actors. So it was kind of nice.
She was able to turn Mom off and turn actors on. She didn't, you know.
Well, sometimes
okay. Sometimes Mom would.
What's your mom is always Mom. You
know? Straighten up, sit up right.
Yeah,
that type of thing.
So. Sure, you want to read the line that way?
Yeah. See, how do you handle that? I mean, did that actually happen? Or?
Jokingly, yes.
Okay, yeah. I was kind of wondering as an actor how you would handle that too. So, but she certainly had the resume to back it up as well. So
she has the credentials.
Now, so that kind of got you into acting. So, what were some of your early roles? Was when did Pippin come into it? So, I mean, we had Carrie before
that.
Oh,
Pippin was quite a bit later. I started. I did a couple things as a kid, but I really didn't think much of being an actor. I thought I was going to fly. I did a lot of flying. My high school and college years, I thought I was going to be a pilot.
That turned out to be a different kind of flying later.
Yeah, exactly. I turned
those wings
into a cape. Yeah.
You're better in an airplane, though, than you were in the games, right?
Okay. I did a lot of theater as a kid, and after I got out of the Air Force, I went back and did theater at South Coast Repertory, a good repertory company that's won a number of Tony Awards. And I worked all over, did a lot of regional theaters over the years. I always did theater when I wasn't doing film or television. My first job was with David Janssen, my first professional job as an actor, with David Janssen and Yaphet Kotto in a movie of the week called Night Chase. And I never looked back from there. I just kept doing episodic and finally landed. I did a film with Ann Baxter that preceded by a year of Carrie. But once I got Carrie, my career just kind of skyrocketed from there, and I was able to, I had a 40-year career from there.
And we're talking about horror movies, we've got to talk about House. Yeah. And you've got some great, a great cast in that. You've got George Wendt from Cheers. You have Richard Mall, who's in Night Court. So what was that experience like working on that? Again, it's one of those smaller films. I think it was only $3 million was the budget or something like that. And it just kind of like blew up.
Yeah, I think the budget was about $3 million, which was still low even at that time in 1985 when we shot that. Which actually, Greatest American Hero predated that. We did from 79 to 83. And then, so after that, I did Baby of the Secret of the Lost Legend for Disney with Sean Young.
Pre-CGI dinosaurs.
Yeah. And then I did, then House was the next film after that. And House really was, I want to throw credit to Steve Miner, who was probably, who was at the helm, was the director. And it was really his sensibility that lended itself to making that film the iconic cult classic that it became.
And of course, you know, we want to talk about, obviously, Greatest American Hero. You got the Red Jammies.
Red Jammies.
Talk about your early meetings with Stephen J. Cannell, who basically created this show. He was given the reins by ABC. They wanted a superhero show, but he didn't necessarily want to do a typical superhero show, right. Did he? It was kind of, he wanted to take a different...
Steve wanted to do a comedy. So he came up with the device that this kid would get this suit and not know how to use it. He would lose the instruction books right away. So I always kind of likened it to putting in a seat of a supersonic jet fighter and not knowing how to fly it. That's in my mind how I always thought of it. And it turned out to be just one of those things that we, you know, it was just a super giant mega hit right out of the box. And then it pretty had a fairly precipitous fall in its third season. I don't know what happened. I think it was because they were throwing us around on the schedule on the weeks. No one could find us. Because our last few shows, as Robert Culp, the late, great Robert Culp, pointed out to me some years ago, our ratings were climbing steeply at the end of that show, but because the audience had found us again, but ABC had canceled us.
Now, when you're talking about The Greatest American Hero coming into this, what I thought was an interesting take on it was, what would an ordinary guy do if he were given these superpowers? And that was it was so accessible to anybody watching it, because you could ask yourself, well, yeah, if little green guys came down and gave me the red jammies. And,
yeah.
And the interesting thing in the show is you weren't the first person to get the red jammies in the show. There's an episode, was it J.J. Beck?
Oh, that's right, J.J. Beck.
The great Joseph Wiseman, who played Dr. No.
Yeah.
He was like the first one who had the suit, and it kind of corrupted him. It just kind of goes through. So what would a guy do when he had this? So how, as an actor coming into this, how did you approach the role of just everyman Ralph Hinkley?
I always played it, and I always thought of it. But my type of comedy is not over the top. I try to play my comedy as a real man in an absurd situation, and that's the way I played it.
And then, working, you mentioned the late, great Robert Culp.
Yep.
I mean, we've got to talk about him. He just, I like those early scenes, especially in the pilot. If you haven't seen the pilot, or if you haven't seen the series, please go get the DVDs and enjoy it.
Yeah,
it's one of the strongest pilots out there. And I love the scenes between the two of you because it wasn't just acting, correct?
No. Robert and I, when we first started the show, we didn't much care for each other. And to put it mildly.
But your characters didn't either.
But the great thing is the characters didn't either. But we were forced to work in this situation. And very much like the TV series, we became very good friends in very short time. Both learning, earning the other's respect professionally. And then that spilled over into our personal lives. And Bob became a very good friend of mine, and I would like to say I was a friend of his.
Yeah, he's amazing. And in his performance, just the two of you, and again, Connie Selica, we throw that in, the
gorgeous, beautiful, very talented Connie Selica, who was not going to be a part of the TV series, and the late, great Steve Cannell talks about this. She was only brought on to do the pilot. But at the end of the dailies in the first week, the chemistry was so strong between the three of us that he called her agent and the network, and they made an overall series deal with Connie. and they kept her in the show.
Well, and what's interesting, too, is she has another comic book connection, because she was in the second Captain America pilot.
Oh, wow.
And then if that had taken off, if that had taken off the series, which it was supposed to, she may have been tied up for that. So because that didn't work out, we actually got her a couple years later on Greatest American Hero. So,
wow.
But the three of you, talk about the dynamic between the three of you, because it just... I mean, it's one of those things, lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
But it just works. How did that come about? How organic was it? How prepared? I know you had table reads going into the episodes.
Well, I hadn't really met Connie until we started shooting. Bob I had met briefly, but I had no, you know, we didn't have any idea who was going to be working with who. It was just one of those serendipitous things where the three of us just worked. That chemistry worked. It's one of those things that you hope to happen as a producer or a casting agent. You hope to get that. And that's when you get these kind of iconic movies or television series that just work. For instance, Friends, or How I Met Your Mom, or those types of series. You just, X-Files, you get this chemistry that you hoped you'd get, but there was no way you could have planned for it.
Yeah. And there's that one scene even in the pilot between you and Robert Culp, too, because I think the problem his character had was that he didn't get the suit.
Right.
He was upset that Ralph Hinkley, every man, got the suit, and he was
right.
the agent. He
That's
was the
right.
he was the crime fighter. He was the one supposed to get it.
That's
and
right.
it's almost like he should have been in charge, and you were the main guy. So it
right.
kind of played out even in the series, because
yeah.
you're obviously the first name we see in the credits.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Robert Culp had been doing a lot of TV shows over that time.
Yeah.
So had you guys talked about that offset? Like how? Like okay.
No, we didn't talk about that. We just did it.
Yeah.
Because I was, you know, a confident young actor. No one was going to really tell me what to do. And Bob thought otherwise. And you laughed. That's exactly what happened. And that's what happened.
And that's what you see in the series.
There was a great scene that we did in the bathroom of the high school where he comes to see me. And he's telling me how it's going to be. And I refute that. And I tell him, no, you don't have it. That's not exactly what's going to transpire here.
Yeah. He's always saying, I'm in charge of the kid.
Yeah, I'm in charge of the kid.
I'm in charge of the kid. No, the kid is in charge of the kid.
Yeah.
Because you're the one with the suit.
Yeah.
Now, talk about the suit itself. Obviously, you're taking on this role. Stephen Cannell talks to you about it. You see it ahead of time.
Yeah.
When do you see the suit? When is the first time you're in it and you go, oh.
One of the first times I saw the suit. Well, you see it in the pilot when I have to put it on. And I look at myself in the mirror for the first time. And I kind of say, hi, sailor. That was funny. I was looking in that mirror, and I was thinking to myself, the way Ralph was thinking to himself, oh, my gosh. And I was thinking to myself, oh, my gosh, there goes my career. That's what Bill Catt was thinking. Yeah.
And so when you took that on, like, you didn't think it was going to go past the pilot stage, or maybe even the first
We thought we were going to do pilot in four shows, maybe.
So you're okay with the suit? It's
yeah, the order was typically a pilot, and they order four shows. That's what they do, and they see how that goes. And then if the ratings are good, then they order more shows.
A lot of Superman references early on.
Yeah.
Were you a comic book fan? Had you enjoyed comic books?
Yeah,
kind of heroes? Did you channel any of those?
Loved comic books. Always a reader and a fan of comic books from the time I was 11, 12 years old. Always jump on my bike and go down to the drugstore, the pharmacy, and you know, in those days, they didn't have comic book stores, or they weren't as accessible. At least I didn't know of any. So we'd go to the drugstore, and they had like a little rack of magazines and comic books. And we'd sit on the back floor, on the tile floor, and we'd read comic books all Saturday morning. And then we'd run off to our Little League games, you know.
Now, the flying sequences, too. I mean, obviously, today, we've got CGI. It's very easy to do flying scenes, very easy to see Man of Steel,
yep.
very easy to do realistic flying scenes. Not so much back in the early 80s.
Yeah.
It was a little bit more low tech. Now, we had the Superman movie with Christopher Reeve. Those types of things were in play, but how did your flying scenes work, and how much of the schedule took up just the flying scenes?
Well, typically every week, I'd be flying, and Connie and Bob would have a day off every week. We'd shoot seven days a show. So we go Monday through Friday, we'd be off Saturday and Sunday, and then Monday and Tuesday, and that would be a full show. Well, typically one of those days was devoted to me on a big giant blue stage, flying, being pulled up by piano wires and zooming across the stage, and they would composite that in with a background. But that was the first year. The second year, by that second year, we had the beginning of the computer age, because they started, the blue screen became a green screen, and I would sit on a green board and the camera would move around me instead of me moving around the camera. That's how things changed.
And then, of course, you had to practice screaming different levels of screaming. There's always different pitches that we watched the different episodes, depending on whether you're going to plow into a wall, into a tree. So, you know, who did you channel for those screams? Those old horror Carrie days, coming back on that?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
All right, well, how about anybody out in the audience? Do you have some questions? We can take some questions.
Yes. Yeah, that was when I auditioned for... they were doing two films. Carrie was being cast, and they were also casting a little-known film called Star Wars. And so we read originally for George Lucas, I met with, and Brian De Palma at the same time. Now, I'm not going to say that I was the only one there. I mean, they were looking at every young, up-and-coming actor in Hollywood, anyone that had some street cred at the time. So I ended up doing an audition with Kurt Russell on our third audition. We memorized lines and we did a reading for camera. We didn't get the role. Kurt Russell just, you know, I don't know why he went into the business in the first place. He never really had it. What's going to become of that guy? You know?
Well, how cool would that be now if we had a movie now that was like a space opera and had the two of you in it? As sort of similar characters. That some Hollywood producer needs to glom onto that.
You won't see William Catt with Kurt Russell on the screen.
Flying in a spaceship. I think everybody would pay to see that. Yeah. Any more questions that we have? Mr. Catt, right here.
Did you see Carrie in
the movie? The new one?
No, the one that you were in.
I saw it sometime after it was out. You know, I was just a struggling, starving young actor at the time. Living on unemployment and playing in a band and doing an occasional acting job. So you do those things at the time. You do the films and they come out. And I think I saw it a couple weeks after it came out.
Did you think it was scary?
I did. I thought it was kind of creepy. And I'm not, I never have really liked to go to see horror films because they freak me out too much. You know, the first time I saw The Fly, which is my first horror film that I ever saw, was The Fly. And, I mean, I threw up. I was a kid.
You actually did that?
I did. I did. It's freaked me out. But Carrie was surprisingly effective, I thought. It was really a good film. It didn't look like the typical B film. Horror films were typically, you know, like The Blob and some of those films. They were B films, but Carrie was a A film. It was like a studio film with some wonderful acting in it. Sissy Spacek got nominated for Best Actress. Piper Laurie got nominated. I don't think the film was, but those two gals were. So it was pretty neat. I mean, within short order, we were in Time Magazine and Newsweek the same week. So my career just went just. As a result of their success, my career took off. And actually, everyone in that film had had a pretty good career after that film.
Another question, right over here.
So I saw Robert Culp and you at a joint theater convention years ago, and the guy seemed, 110%. He was so high energy.
Yep.
You know, you didn't mean this now.
Yep.
His later years.
Yep.
So was that like how he was on set?
Oh, my God, yes.
He was amazing in person.
He was a dynamo. Bob was always like that, going 100 miles an hour, always thinking. Bob Culp always thought of himself as a writer first.
Yeah.
He was in the Writers Guild. If you look at his IMDb, he was in the Writers Guild. Very successful. He thought of himself as a director second, and he directed two of the episodes in 3 years. He directed two, was set to direct two more. And then he thought of himself as an actor thirdly. So that's how the process went in Bob's head. Yeah, he was a dynamo. We were very, very lucky to have him on the show, and he's certainly one of the keystones of why that series was a success.
And we had a question.
Yes,
here in the corner.
When Billy yells at you in the show, do you ever feel like yelling back?
Oh, yeah. The question was, when Bill yells at me in the show, do I feel like yelling back? And I said I did quite often. Yes.
Yeah, you did give him a little pushback in a few scenes.
Yes, I did.
It's always fun to watch the two of you going together. And even in the pilot for The Greatest American Heroine, which came after all this, I love the scenes of the two of you in the beginning when you pick a skirt. Of all people, you picked a skirt to take over the suit, as he calls it. So there's another play where we get to see the great Bob Culpin that as well, too. We have a question right here.
When you did the return of Perry Mason,
yes.
And you were Paul Drake Jr., what caused you, I lost track, I forget how many episodes you were in, and then you left the show. And what caused you to leave the show then?
The question was, I did the series after Hero. I ended up on working with Raymond Burr and my mom on the Perry Mason specials, which were two-hour movie of the weeks that then played on NBC. And I left the show after about 4.5 years, and I went to do, the reason being is I went to do another show with Steve Cannell, a show called Top of the Hill. It was short-lived. We only shot 13 episodes. It was one of my personal favorites that I ever did. It was about a young Democrat who was elected in a special election for Congress from his district in California. And we were short-lived, but that's what happened there. That's why I left the Masons and did that. I expected that would run a few years. It was one of my favorite things, a very, very smart show, along the lines of L.A. Law, Steve Bochco's show. But we just didn't resonate with the public, I guess. That's the best analogy that I could make.
You mentioned Stephen Cannell. Let's talk a little bit about him as well, because we lost him a few years ago. What did we lose? I mean, talk about his writing, his style, his working with the actors, all those different things that made him such a special person in life.
Well, Steve was, above all else, a wonderful leader. He really knew how to gather the best and the most talented people around him. And his company, there must be 2,000 people that's come through his companies in one form or another as editors, showrunners, writers, directors. A lot of the technical people that are working out there today were young folks at the time working with Steve Cannell organization. He was responsible for the Rockford Files and about 43 other shows that
A-Team
we've all seen. And then he left that and became a best-selling novelist, and he did about 9 or 10 bestsellers before he passed.
Do we have any Castle fans in the audience? The TV show Castle? Yeah, you'll notice he's on some of those episodes as they sit around the poker table. And then
let me have the story about Castle is that Rob Bowman, who's the executive producer on that, was a young PA on our show. He was in his early 20s at the time on Greatest American Hero. And his dad was one of the directors on Greatest American Hero. And Rob grew up to then work and did a lot of the X-Files and did the first big X-Files movie as the director. And that's kind of his journey. And now he has the number one show on TV. You know?
It was a nice little moment, too, that after he passed away, because there was a shot where
there's
a poker table and he comes in, somebody almost sits down, he says, nope, that's Candle Seat. And it stays open. And I thought that was such a nice touch.
Very nice.
That they did for that, too. So, talk about Grace American Hero. What was the most challenging aspect for you of shooting the series? Because you're in every shot. It's you the whole
time. That was the most challenging aspect was the time. When you do a single show, single camera, as they call it, a single camera show, and you're the lead, you're working literally 14 to 16 hours every day, so you never see your family or friends. And that's why people, these celebrities, they have their assistants you hear about, because they literally don't have any time to do anything, you know? So that's the hardest part about doing a one-camera show.
Again, looking back at the series, what are some of your favorite moments? What are some of the moments that you kind of keep with you to this day and go, oh, that was pretty special?
Gee whiz. We're going back a long way, but I always enjoyed working with Connie and being out in location and being in the red suit was kind of fun because at the time it was kind of a novelty and people hadn't seen it and didn't know the suit, so I could walk down the street and literally stop traffic. And that was a lot of fun for me.
Did you, at some point, because I know early on it was like, oh, the suit, I gotta wear the suit. But at some point did you kind of embrace it and like be okay with it? And I know even on a recent TV Land, was it TV Land Awards? I think you actually put the suit back on again.
Yeah.
So you got to be okay with it at some point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm okay with the suit. It's okay. The suit and I have become bros. You know? Hey, thank you all very much. I really, really
appreciate
it. Great running chat, everybody. Thank you.
Once again, my thanks to William Catt for not only taking part in the Q&A at the convention, but for appearing on Comic Book Central a few months back. If you haven't had a chance to listen to that interview, check it out. It's episode 31 of Comic Book Central. And thanks also to Glenn Nelson and High Adventure for, I'm telling you what, making that day truly unforgettable. Thanks, guys and girls. Appreciate that. That was an awesome moment. Be sure to check out High Adventure's site, High Adventure Music. .com. Their newest album, The Trials of Obi-Wan, is now available. And, you know, one of High Adventure's songs off their last album is The Fury of Darth Maul. Now, fortunately, I didn't meet up with Fury of Darth Maul, but I did meet up with a very nice man who portrayed Darth Maul, as well as X-Men's Toad and G.I. Joe's Snake Eyes, actor Ray Park. Born in Scotland, raised in England, Ray Park first stormed Hollywood with Fists and Feet of Fury as a stuntman extraordinaire in the films Mortal Kombat Annihilation and the Headless Horseman's double in Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow. But it was his turn as the Dathomirian Dark Lord Darth Maul that took the world by storm. Maul was easily the coolest part of Star Wars Episode 1, and while the character didn't last through the closing credits, that spectacular battle scene where Ray Park wields the double-bladed lightsaber is iconic. Ray then went on to appear as Toad in Bryan Singer's X-Men, and he's currently blowing up the box office in the G.I. Joe series as Snake Eyes. Well, I want to welcome to the show an actor with several blockbuster franchise films under his belt and more to come, Ray Park. Welcome to Comic Book Central. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me. How you doing?
Thank you for being here. When you're at a convention like this, and Comic-Con is pretty big, I mean, you got a lot of things going on. What topic do fans want to talk about most? You've been in all these different franchises that we've talked about. What seems to be the one that they're hitting you most with?
Oh, Darth Maul is always popular in Star Wars, and I think with Star Wars it hits a lot of generations. You know, dads are coming up, grandmas coming up because they've seen the originals, and for me, being part of the new series, I'm very lucky, you know. So it's great to see a lot of families come up. But for me, because I played like in X-Men and G.I. Joe, so it depends where I go, and it's a good mix of people who like different things. But it's always about Darth Maul.
Is that your personal favorite? Because you see the light up when you talk about Darth Maul a little
bit. No, because Darth Maul got me my start. Without Darth Maul, I wouldn't be playing Snake Eyes, I don't think, or Toad. It got me. It was my introduction into the film business, and but I love Snake Eyes, you know, because he's my first good guy role, you know, and I grew up with Snake Eyes. I grew up with Star Wars. I grew up with He-Man and Thundercats.
Yeah.
And Transformers.
It's like your childhood coming to life.
Yeah, you get to really
now somebody's
childhood.
Paying you for it to play these things.
I'm getting to be a big kid, you know.
Yeah. Now you were introduced. You see in your movies, you see a lot of martial arts action. We see a lot of physical action things going on. You were introduced to martial arts by your father. Correct?
Yeah.
He was a fan of martial arts. He's a big fan of Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
Correct? So I'm interested to find out, like, how did that come about? Like, what sparked your interest then in that? Like, he was introducing this to you, and then, how did you become interested?
I was pretty much into a lot of things. I grew up watching The Bionic Man and Wonder Woman and The Hulk, you know, a Spider-Man TV show. So I liked anything
all
that
our favorites.
Yeah, like anything that captivated my imagination as a kid. And martial arts seemed to have this superpower sort of thing because they could do things and then do gymnastics. And I just liked it. As a kid, I was very active. I was always climbing buildings and trying to do stunts and trying to relive what I saw in films. And it was something that didn't come easy to me to do, but I enjoyed it, you know. And I grew up watching Rocky movies, so I loved that. Inspired me as a martial artist. And then seeing Star Wars for the first time and watching Luke Skywalker and Empire Strikes Back have his training from Yoda, that's when I really got into martial arts because he was doing handstands with Yoda on his back and somersaults. And that's when I was like, you know what, I'm going to get into martial arts because martial arts seems to have everything, you know, like Star Wars. You know?
Yeah. Now, speaking of martial arts, you got to actually play Chuck Norris in a Chinese TV series.
Yeah.
Is it The Legend of Bruce Lee?
Yeah.
How did that role come to you?
I was training at Wushu Center in LA at the time, and they were auditioning different people, and I was asked, would I want to be part of, but I'd like to audition for Chuck Norris for a Bruce Lee TV show. And I thought, yeah, why not?
Great gig.
I'm a big fan of Bruce Lee, so like to play Chuck Norris was, I knew I wasn't going to play Bruce Lee, but but just to go out.
Chuck Norris you can pull off.
Yeah, and you know, it was.
Well, I'm a toad, I mean, yeah, so I'm, it doesn't, I'm never
good,
say never.
I'm a big fan of, even though I don't look like anything like Chuck Norris, or but just to be part of something to do with Bruce Lee, I wanted to be part of it.
Had you ever met Chuck Norris?
No, not yet.
Okay. So did you ever get any feedback from him or hear from his people or anything about it?
No, I didn't. Okay. My dad said you should, you know, reach out to him, but I sort of figured that if I did, he might tell me not to do it. So, and also, I was, I'm a big fan of Chuck Norris. I highly respect him. So I just wanted to go to China and work on this project.
What's your favorite Chuck Norris fact? Do you know those Chuck Norris facts?
It was like... something to do with Chuck Norris doesn't breathe. He, you know, something. I've got two T-shirts with Chuck Norris slogans on it. So.
I think Death once had a near Chuck Norris experience. That's one of my favorite ones. And then I saw a new one. Chuck Norris doesn't need Twitter. He's already following you.
All right.
So that was
that's a good one. That's a good one.
So you mentioned you're a fan of the original Star Wars trilogy. Let's talk about now. There were two things that happened big in your career: 1999 and 2000. You got Star Wars, Episode One. You played Darth Maul, and then X-Men. So these back to back. Let's talk about Star Wars first. Who approached you? Did you have initial conversations with George Lucas? How did that all come about?
No, I was approached by Nick Gillard, the stunt coordinator of Phantom Menace, and he had heard about me from a movie I did called Mortal Kombat Annihilation. So I was working on that first, and my whole goal was to get into films. The reason why I got into martial arts as well was to get into movies. I was fascinated by it, and it's something I wanted to do, but I never thought I would be working in Hollywood. I wanted to go out to Asia and work in Jackie Chan movies. That's what I wanted to do. That was my dream, being a martial artist. And then I was called in to audition, and then I got the part. And X-Men and Star Wars weren't really back-to-back. I had like a good 3 years in between, because by the time Phantom Menace came out, then I got offered X-Men. So for me, it wasn't back-to-back.
But okay.
In movie-wise, they seem like
so a lot longer production time on the Star Wars film than
Phantom
they had
Menace was. Phantom Menace was like a couple of years of my life.
Wow.
Because I was called back to do some things and stuff like that. So it was great. It was great to have that experience.
Now, did you know, I mean, unfortunately, Darth Maul only lasted the one film, but did you know much about his backstory? Did you get to fill in some of the gaps with George Lucas or the writers or anything? Well, or did you know anything about his backstory?
There was no backstory, really. That was just... You know,
did you make up actors sometimes make up their own backstory? Did you make up one for him so you could channel something?
Yeah, I had my own character for Darth Maul, and that's what I portrayed, you know. But there was no like, oh, where did he come from? I did ask all those questions, but George just said, it's up to you. Wherever you think he was, wherever you think he would be, that's where this was good with you. So
that's a pretty easy way to go into it. Yeah. So you kind of create your own little backstory.
Yeah,
like,
you know, it was up to me, you know, like wherever.
Maybe he had a rough childhood or something. Something like that. Now, what martial arts did you incorporate into the fight choreography? Because we see like a massive battle at the end, which is really cool.
Well, I wouldn't say I sort of, you know, incorporated anything. I just incorporated myself. You know, like whatever I do and whatever weapon I was holding is what I did. You know, like, so I practice Shaolin Kung Fu and Wushu, and of course it has to be within the world of Star Wars. You know, so.
Yeah. How long did it take to choreograph that fight? Because it is really involved, and it plays on screen for a long time, and it's just nonstop.
Yeah. The choreography came up in pieces. You know, we would make up, we'd be rehearsing a good couple of months beforehand, coming up with different style, like different fight sequences. But some of them would happen by accident when we were goofing around. Like myself and the other stunt guys, we would play around like what would you do if I came at you like this? So it was a lot of fun. It was like a test, you know, like he would come at me with different moves and I would spin and react. And then we would go, oh, that was really good. What did we do? And then so we would start documenting, filming the stuff we did. And it came down to like just calling the fights, number one fight, number two fight, okay. 3-2-1 fight. And then once George had seen it and loved it, then we locked it down and kept those fights as they were. So they came in different pieces.
So it was organic as it was coming together.
Was, yeah.
I mean, it wasn't anything like, here's this, A, no, B. We didn't, just, we you're like, oh, that worked.
Yeah, we didn't go, all right, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. We just go, okay, let's see what works here. Because we wanted to show the best fights, because it was a new 20 years since Star Wars had been out. And George had wanted to show the Jedis in their prime. and utilize what I can do. So, of course, as a martial artist, I could have done, there was more things I wanted to do, but it would become too much of a martial art fight. We wanted to make it a Jedi Star Wars
fight.
That's
its own thing.
Yeah.
Like yeah, it, I mean, there's similarities, but...
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's where the difference had been. So, you know, and it was a case of like, okay, kids, go, and I would hold the lightsaber, and then, you know, Andreas, who's the assistant stunt coordinator, would just come at me, and he was phenomenal. And we'd play characters from video games and reenact, you know, stuff from Soul Calibur. And wow. And then that sort of became, it was an influence in the fights.
Okay, so now I'm going to watch that a whole different way now when I watch it. So
especially cool. The behind-the-scenes stuff, because that's where you'll see it. You know?
Yeah, some great. Now, question from my IndieCast co-host, Keith Voss. He is a huge Darth Maul fan. He says, your character was killed off at the conclusion of The Phantom Menace, only to be resurrected in the Clone Wars animated TV series. What do you think about that character coming back to life again? Do you think it was necessary to do that? And have you kind of been following the character off and on through these adventures?
Well, only recently I realized Darth Maul came back for the length of time he did in the Clone Wars. I knew he came, everyone was talking, you know, when his brother came back. And of course I was like, oh yeah, I'm a bit jealous because everyone's talking about Savage. And then I didn't know that Maul had such a big presence in the series, and I only recently watched it with my kids, and then I was like, wow, I wish I'd followed this when it was out, because I might have sucked up to George a bit more to try and get in the new Star Wars, because I realized that Darth Maul may come back.
It's still a conversation you could have.
And it's in that time period as well, where the Clone Wars is, you know, I know Clone Wars is like around about episode 2 sort of period, isn't it? 2 and 3.
It's a build-up.
So, yeah, I think it's great. I think Sam, who did the voice for it, did a great job, and I saw him just a few weeks ago, and it's awesome to see, you know, because the fans have been waiting for it. For me, I knew it was done and dusted. It was, you know, you watched the other movies, and I knew I could have been slotted in somewhere in the movies, but at the time, I was just grateful to be part of Star Wars. It didn't bother me if I was brought back or not or killed. I just had that moment to be part of
it. It's forever, yeah. I mean, you're in that. So, and it's my personal favorite character from that, from the original, from the prequels. So he's the coolest thing.
I owe George and Lucas from my career, really, because they got me started. You know, they took a chance on this 22-year-old boy fresh out competing in Wushu, and my goal was to go and work in movies somehow. I wanted to do stunts and acting. And
Didn't get bigger in Star Wars.
Yeah, and it gave me a break. So
yeah, it doesn't get bigger in Star Wars. One of your other breaks you mentioned in 2000, Mortimer Toynbee, also known as Toad. He first appeared in X-Men 4 in 1964. So happy 50th anniversary, Toad. Oh, yeah. So happy 50th anniversary to you.
I will be 50s in some years to come.
Some years to come. This is your first speaking role, correct?
That was since Star Wars.
Because you didn't do the voice in Star Wars, but then this was your first speaking role. Yeah. So again, those two huge breaks coming off of each other. What do you like about the character Toad? What do you like about his powers? What did you find fascinating about the character?
At the time, I didn't like Toad because I followed X-Men, and I followed everything to do with DC and Marvel as a kid. So I knew what Toad was like in the comics. And Brian had offered me Pyro first. Okay. So I was like, oh, you know, great. What can I do with fire? You know, so I was thinking, you know, Jackie Chan-ish, Jet Li, what I could do, Tai Chi Master type with flames and stuff.
Yeah.
And Toad was in, and I read for Pyro. I practically was going to be part of X-Men, but they wanted me to be Pyro first. And then they felt that Toad would be better with my ability. So they offered me Toad.
Is this because of like all the different positions he has to get into
possibly.
And the physicality?
Yeah,
of what
they wanted to show me my physical side. You know, use that. You
instead
know?
Of just here's a fireball.
I wasn't a straight actor; I was a physical actor. Yeah. You know, and so I was like, Toad. I knew what Toad was like, and Brian had this conversation with me because I was hesitant, and I'd just come off from Star Wars, so everything was going great, and he just said, "Look, Ray, this is a great opportunity for you to show a character and show something new about it and reinvent it if you want." So when he told me that, I was really thrilled to be Toad, and I love Toad now. I wish I was to come back as Toad, because he's one of those characters that I can goof off and play, and I can really get away with a lot of stuff. And a lot of the ideas came to me at the end of shooting for Toad, whereas I didn't do a lot of prep work for it, but when it started to digest, and I have kids now and I play with it, I could actually really get into it.
What exactly did happen when Toad got struck by lightning?
I think he survives. You know, because I was still screaming all the way down when I hit the Hudson River. So,
all right. Have you seen the new ones?
No, I haven't seen it. No, okay. I haven't had a chance. I don't go to the movies that much unless we see Disney or cartoons, you know, with my kids. My wife and I don't really go out to the movies that much, or I catch up with movies on a plane. But I don't really like to watch them on a plane because I want to watch them on a big screen.
I know we're a little tight for time here. We mentioned about G.I. Joe. That's some of the newer stuff that you're working on right now. Is there another G.I. Joe coming out?
I hope
out?
So, yeah.
Okay.
Hope
so, so we see your Snake Eyes. You talked about G.I. Joe as a kid, so like you had the G.I. Joes?
Yeah, I did. I grew up, it was Action Man when I was a
kid.
And then it became Action Force. But it was G.I. Joe, but Snake Eyes was there, you know. He was a commando. To me, he was like an SAS guy to me. And I always wanted to be in Special Forces as a kid. There was something romantic and heroic, if that's the right word, about it. And so I became Snake Eyes, and I sort of relived my childhood.
So hopefully more in the franchise?
I hope so.
Latest projects, what do you got going on now? What's shooting here?
I had a movie come out on Jin, a movie called Jin that came out earlier this year. And then hopefully G.I. Joe 3.
Sounds good. A website, anything? How can fans get a hold of you?
At conventions.
Okay. Raypark.com?
That's under construction at the moment.
Okay,
but it will
so we'll
be
get
back
that
up.
Out there. We'll look forward to that website coming up.
That would be the best. I mean, I want to do some new stuff with teaching videos and stuff like that on there, and people can learn how to do a butterfly or a butterfly twist and some tips, like Lou does on his website. Yeah, you know, he sort of incorporates his sports side, his physical side.
He's got like five websites.
He does?
He's got a ton of them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. I know his son works with him as well. His son is awesome. So.
Well, talk to him about his website. So. Hey, Ray, I remember when Star Wars Episode 1 came out, just that image of Darth Maul gave me chills. I thought it was the coolest looking character. You've made him more memorable with your performance. So Darth Maul lives. I thank you for joining us here on Comic Book Central today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Feel the Force.
Whew, man, can you believe all those great guests? And there is still more Comic Book Central at Connecticut Comic Con? It is going to have to wait until next week, though, because that is all the time we have for today in this expanded episode of Comic Book Central. My thanks to everyone that I met at the convention, who appeared on the show today, my fellow podcasters, Mitch Halleck, Laird Malamud, Brian Letendre, Matt Herring, and my special guest, Neil Adams, Jerry Ordway, William Catt, and Ray Park. My geek brain is still reeling from the nerdvana that is Connecticut Comic Con. Be sure to make plans for 2015 Comic Con at Comic Con. That's comiccon2ns.com. A lot of great stuff coming up, and we already know the Indiana Jones map room is going to be there. And hey, while you're checking out websites, be sure to check out Comic Book Central's new website. We had a soft rollout this week just to test the waters a little bit. comicbookcentral.net. You'll see art by the talented Brandon Wilt. You can check out Brandon's work at bentwookiecomics.blogspot.com. I'll put that link up in the show notes. And it's all put together in a nice little virtual package by the equally talented Dante Tate at Margante Studios. You can find out more about Dante's work at Margante, margante.com. Let me know what you think about the new website, and check out my picks from the convention on Twitter and Facebook. There's a ton of them. I know I don't have them all up yet. I've got a few cool ones. There's Darth Maul. He's up there. Ray Park. William Catt. He's up there, too. Some of the panel. I'm posting as I go. So much to keep up with this week. Check it out. Facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network and Twitter at ComicBookCTRL. Be sure to hashtag share the lair. You know you want to tell your friends about everything you heard on this week's show. And of course, you're going to want to tell them about the next episode, because next week on Comic Book Central, you've seen him in the Marvel movies, you've seen him in the Marvel one-shots, he's on your television in Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and he has some memorable moments in Captain America Winter Soldier. Next week, you will hear my conversation with S.H.I.E.L.D. agent, S.H.I.E.L.D. agent? Jasper Sitwell, actor Maximiliano Hernandez, caps off my adventures at Connecticut Comic Con. Until then, have an amazing week, keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations, 3.0 Unported License. All of the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
We shall meet again! Ha!